Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Keynote by CNBC Events. I'm Tyler Matheson. On this podcast, we bring you in-depth, candid conversations with executives, experts, and thought leaders. Today, you'll hear from economist, MIT professor, and author Darren Acemoglu. His most recent book is entitled Power and Progress, Our Thousand-Year Struggle Over Technology and Prosperity. He spoke with my colleague Emily Wilkins at CNBC's Work Summit on December 6, 2023, about the threat that artificial intelligence poses to the human workforce and what both Silicon Valley and Washington must do to create what he calls pro-human AI. Here's their conversation.
I just wanted to start off with kind of the 30,000-foot view. I mean, you've talked a lot in your most recent book, Power and Progress, the Thousand-Year Struggle Over Technology and Prosperity. You really looked at a number of economic developments throughout the year, things like the Industrial Revolution, what happened with the cotton gin, and how they impacted the economy and workers. And so I wanted to ask, given all of that research you've done on previous economic developments, when it comes to AI, what really is the best case scenario here for workers, and what's the worst case scenario?
Thanks for having me on the program, Emily. I'm really excited to be talking to you about this very important topic. And the reason why I think it's really important is because there is such a huge gap between the best case scenario and the worst case scenario here. We are dealing with an impressive, transformative technology, but one whose future path is still unwritten. So we can steer it in very different directions. The best case scenario is that AI will develop as a pro-worker tool, meaning it will keep humans at the center. It will try to make humans more capable, more knowledgeable, better problem solvers, better able to deal with complex tasks. And as such, it will help workers earn a better living, create more good jobs, perhaps in the very best case scenario, even reduce inequality because it can boost the capabilities of workers with middle levels of skills. But the worst case scenario is also very scary. It will damage the economy by laying off a lot of workers because it will go down a very rapid automation path. It would boost inequality between capital and labor, between different types of labor. It can also damage democracy and many other aspects of the social fabric of our lives. So I think there are really super important questions we have to be focusing on right now.
And one of the things that you talk about when you discuss AI is not so much the intelligent aspect, but the machine usefulness aspect. How can AI really help enhance the jobs that people are already doing rather than replace them in those jobs? And I want to see really, again, kind of a 30,000-foot view, how do we make sure that that happens in the coming years?
Well, thank you for bringing that up. I think this is really the centerpiece of it, because how we use AI is going to really depend on how we conceptualize it, what are our priorities, what are our aspirations. And a lot of the AI field has been shaped by the path-breaking ideas of Alan Turing and his followers, which put autonomous machine intelligence at the center of what we are trying to achieve. Artificial general intelligence, trying to create more and more human-like machines, is very much motivated by this agenda. But the alternative, what Simon Johnson and I call machine usefulness, is really what we should be striving for, trying to make the machines better for humans. And I think the way to achieve that is, first of all, having this conversation. We really need to start building a consensus around the idea that it is feasible and it is socially desirable to have pro-worker, pro-human AI. And then we need to start thinking about what is the institutional structure to best guarantee that. Is it better to delegate all of these decisions to a few very powerful people in Silicon Valley, or do we need a broader conversation among regulators, democratic process, and of course, the very talented tech people? And then we have to think about specific policies to redress the distortions that exist in the current wave of AI. I think given that there are such tremendously different outcomes, it is big item of faith to say that the market's going to sort it out by itself.
You mentioned, you know, the regulators, you mentioned Silicon Valley, but I'm wondering what you would suggest for the business leaders who are in our audience today when it comes to them looking at AI and how they should be using it in their companies. What kind of advice or what kind of warnings do you have for them about how they should be thinking about this new technology and how it will interact with their current employees?
Wonderful question. And I think this is really so important as well, because there are really two ways in which for business leaders to think about their workforce. One, and I'm simplifying, obviously, you can think of it as the labor cost as something to be cut. The other one is you can think of your workers as your most important resource, and you have to boost their capabilities. And of course, every business leader does a little bit of both. But when you go down the path of automation, and when you see ChatGPT or GPT-4 or the applications built on them and say, oh, well, you know, I can lay off 20% of my workforce if I just could get them to do these tasks, you are really thinking of labor as something to be cut. But if you start thinking of, actually, I can use these tools to make my workers perform more complex tasks, increase the quality, reliability of the products I offer. I create a much better ecosystem for very complex problems that are not even on the agenda of many other business leaders. I think that will actually push you further ahead of your competitors. And I think the reason why I'm emphasizing this is because it's socially problematic if we just use new technologies for automating work and sidelining workers, but it hasn't worked out always that well for companies either. So there is room for business leaders to play an inspiring leadership role here.
But I do think for a lot of business leaders, they are under pressure to have profit, they're under pressure to make money, and I think for a number of them, I'm sure the idea of being able to cut down their workforce and continue doing what they're doing is going to be very attractive. And so I want to bring in the regulator part here. What does Washington and other regulators really need to do to make sure that companies have the right incentives here when it comes to this mix between AI and the workers?
You're absolutely right. You know, if you look at when automation gets a lot of boost in the US, for example, it's when Japanese competition and then competition from imports from China have surged. So absolutely, you can understand why business leaders are going to be focused on cost cutting during certain periods of time. But our policies have not helped either. You know, we subsidize the introduction of automation machinery and we tax labor heavily. So when you're a business leader and you're thinking of investing in the training of your employees, you know, the government tax code does not incentivize that. So I think we have to give better incentives for investing in humans to business leaders. And also, look, we are dealing with what economists call a general purpose technology, a technology that has many, many applications that can be developed in many different ways. So here, the government also has a leadership role in encouraging the tech industry to develop the tools that are going to be more useful to humans, that are going to be more pro-worker. I think both subsidies and taxes have to play a role in creating the right kind of market environment. I'm definitely not a believer in saying bureaucrats should decide the direction of technology or the government has to keep a tight leash on the technology, but the government has to create the institutional framework for the market to thrive, especially when we're dealing with such transformative technologies here.
And that would be a big thing for Congress to do. I know that you have spoken with a number of members of Congress. You've testified. You've been a part of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's AI forums. Do you get the sense that this is something Congress actually has an interest in, kind of changing the tax code to make sure that there's an emphasis on companies continuing to hire actual humans?
Absolutely. I think lawmakers are really waking up to this. You know, the first time I testified several years ago, you know, one lawmaker said, why are we talking about AI when we have such important, urgent problems? I don't think you're going to hear from any senator or representative today. And I think they have become much more informed. They really understand what's at stake in terms of jobs, in terms of democracy. Look, we've focused on work here, which is very much top of my mind and top of the minds of many business leaders as well. But there's also the effects of generative AI on democracy, on communication, on mental health. All of these things, I think, are now quite clearly recognized by our lawmakers, which is great. We're actually making progress.
And Darren, I did want to ask you very quickly, just kind of the direction that you currently see this balance between AI and the human workforce going. You had a recent op-ed in the LA Times where you talked about OpenAI, their firing and then rehiring of Sam Altman, and some of the concerns that you felt from that. I'm just wondering kind of from that, what direction do you overall see companies going when it comes to AI?
Well, I was trying to be optimistic, Emily, but you know, you've put your finger on the cracks of the matter. I think the technical capabilities are there. We can really steer this in a very socially beneficial direction. But unfortunately, that's not the direction we're going in right now. And I think the OpenAI saga is indicative of that. You know, OpenAI, because of its very special structure as a nonprofit corporation with a very, very profitable subset that was led by Sam Altman, you know, really had all of these conflicts embedded in it. And there were people that, you know, wanted guardrails, and there were people within the company who wanted to go as fast as possible. There are other aspects to it. We don't know exactly what happened, but I think the incentive in the industry, especially with venture capital, and especially with the idea that you have to dominate the market by becoming the largest player, I think those are not helping, because they're making us rush down the easiest road, the lowest resistance path, which is often automation. Just follow the previous models, and especially for platforms, you know, collect more and more data. I don't think that's going to get us to the kinds of aspirations that are articulated, where we can make blue-collar workers, electricians, nurses, teachers much more capable, because we give them tools to be better workers and to create much higher quality services. I think that's the aspiration, but it's going to take some sort of step back, think about where we want to go, how we can actually achieve that. That we're not doing that right now.
That was economist Darren Acemoglu. He joined us at CNBC's Work Summit on December 6, 2023. The Keynote is produced by the CNBC Events team. And if you enjoyed this conversation, please share with your friends. You can visit cnbcevents.com to learn about upcoming events and how you can join us. We'd love to have you there. I'm Tyler Matheson. Thanks for listening.